Associate Professor of Applied Psychology and Director of the University of Calgary's Applied Psychological and Educational Services. His business card is about this big in order to get that all on there. His work in private practice, the University of Calgary, and with the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada has greatly contributed to psychosocial factors contributing to adolescent and family behavior. He has been with the IMFC for a number of years now. It's always a pleasure to talk and see Kelly. We often get together in Calgary for early morning breakfast and solve the world's problems at that particular time. Nobody listens to us when we solve those problems, though. Kelly is presenting a paper this afternoon that will be available to you very soon. We'll make sure that everybody that is here today receives a copy of that paper as well. And I always look forward to hearing Kelly. He's bringing new cutting-edge research specific to Canadian context. And so for that reason, it's my pleasure to welcome. And please join us now, Kelly. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, good afternoon. Thanks for hanging in with us and with me. As the research fellow, I rarely get the good speaking spots, and today again, I get the after the break.
Save the best for last.
Yeah, I've heard that for 5 or 6 years now. And in fact, if you wouldn't mind taking out your salmon-colored sheet, you'll notice how all of the other speakers have nicely coiffed bio pictures, whereas my picture captures me in a stunned state of confusion and/or disbelief, which, surprisingly enough, for any of you who know me even a little bit, that's a pretty accurate picture. So for me to present anything otherwise would be inaccurate. Good for me to be with you today. I'm really excited to be a part of the IMFC conference and to work with these folks all year round. And it was about 3 months ago, well, more than that, 4 months ago, that this stopped working. I'm going to make sure we get this. I just want to make sure this goes before I... Oh, you know what's happened? Hang on. Okay, you'll get that going. There it is. Andrew here had called me literally about 3.5 months ago. I was leaving the campus of University of Calgary, where I direct a clinic that's staffed entirely by graduate students in our program in applied psychology at the U of C, and was driving home from work after a rather typical day, supervising about 20 or 30 graduate students in our clinic, and was listening on the radio as they were just announcing the nominees for the 2000, and I don't know if that would have been 10 or 11 Academy Awards, and they were running through the list of films, and one that caught my attention was a film entitled The Kids Are All Right. How many of you have heard of that? Have heard of that film? I was immediately drawn in by the title because one of the questions I go to work trying to answer and leave work trying to process is, are the kids all right? How do you and I understand in both common ways and in social scientific ways the answer to that question? Are the kids all right? Now again, I work in a clinical field where sadly I do leave my place of work doubting the positive answer to that question, because in my work, as I'm going to tell you about, we deal lots with kids and families that are either in distress and or in crisis in regards to their personal functioning. And so I was enamored by this question, so when Andrew called me a few days later, I was thinking about this notion of, you know, do we have a good sense of the state of our children's mental health here in Canada? Do we have the data to really support whether or not we can answer in the positive or the negative about the question of whether our kids are all right or not? Now, again, I'm going to present to you as in somewhat state of dissonance. So that's why I'm saying this picture of me is rather accurate, because trained as a clinical psychologist, my role and job is to look for things that are not right, to look for things that are wrong, dysfunctional, to look for illness, and to in some way assess that and diagnose that, and then provide a course of action to deal with that. But at the same time, I have said kind of tongue in cheek here that my background is also as a social developmentalist. In fact, I joke with some people that I may be the love child of Yuri Bronfenbrenner. And for those of you that have taken an intro psych class, you get that joke. For those of you that haven't, Yuri Bronfenbrenner was a bioecologist who looked at the connection of all the contexts that contribute to the development of a child. And really, that's where my heart and passion is looking at all those contexts. And yet, I find myself immersed in a field of both practice and study that has heavily been, in some ways, you know, loosely hijacked by the medical model, in the sense that the individual child equals individual sickness or individual ill health. But that goes counter to really where I sit in my framework of understanding of child and adolescent development. In fact, in some ways, we are better able to talk about what's wrong with children and youth and families, more so than we're better able to discuss what's right with them, what's going well, what contributes to their well-being. And this is the tension that I exist in, and I want you to invite you to this world a little bit today. So I want to present you with a picture here that we're going to start with, as I have done with my three kids, we're going to start with the vegetables and work through to the dessert. We're going to get through the distasteful, bland tasting part of this, because we're going to talk about what's not going well. But I don't want you to miss that the focus of my talk today and the focus of the paper that is forthcoming is to really leave us with a sense of, but you know what? The future for our children is not only bright, the present for our future is bright as well. And we need to, I want to promote that as a developmental psychologist, that in fact we have lots to be hopeful about, not only about our future for our kids, but the present for our kids. But, so let's start with the negative. I start by citing a interestingly enough, a report by Kelly Leach. Did she get elected in her riding? She published a report in 2007 where she was serving as an advisor on healthy children and youth, and looked at some of the OECD reports that, in fact, one of our previous presenters mentioned about how this ranks nations in regards to some of the national outcomes. And you can see here that in a number of areas, Canada ranks very poorly. The one I'm most curious and interested about is that last bullet point, that we rank 21st in child well-being, including children's mental health. So as we consider everything that we're going to talk about here, no matter what our state of economy or our state of our political system, we rank amongst our OECD partners quite poorly in regards to our children's mental health. The report of Dr. Leach goes on to make five recommendations, including access to pediatric mental health services, reducing wait time for those services, and addressing health and human constraints through training. So it is a very positively focused report. It leads to outcomes that we hope will make noticeable change. But at the same time, given this report is only 4 or 5 years in age, I can tell you right now that we are still way behind in achieving or even addressing some of these issues. Now, when we look at the smaller picture, so again, big picture, looking at comparing Canada versus the rest of the world. Now let's get small into the borders of our nation. And I present to you again some of the stats that all of us probably are fairly well familiar with. We know, in fact, when I get asked how well are our children doing, one of the things I say is that, well, you know what, 80% of our kids are doing not only well, but in fact quite well or very well. That in fact most of our kids are finishing a high school, most of our kids are not engaging in early drug and alcohol use or early sexual activity. Most of our kids are doing very well. But what you often hear is people citing the alternative to that, that about 20% or about 1 in 5 of our children and adolescents suffer from some sort of developmental, emotional, or behavioral problem. Some are saying that rather bleakly, and I guess this is the impetus for my paper and some of the research that I'm doing, is that as soon as 2020, so in less than 10 years, we are at risk of seeing this increase upwards of 1 in 2 or at least 1 in 3 children experiencing significant mental, emotional, and or behavioral difficulties. Again, this comes out of the Offord Center. 1 in 10 has an aggressive behavior problem. From Canadian Mental Health Association, approximately 300 children and youth commit suicide, and up to 90% of those successful suicide actions are preceded by some form of mental health issue, most notably depression and or anxiety. And interestingly enough, a recent report, suicide rates have decreased in most first world areas, with notably exception of Canada and a couple of other first world countries, where in fact our suicide rates have not decreased but have stayed the same, which again for us is not something that we should be very proud of. So do we have children and youth in our country that have, you know, mental, social, emotional, behavioral needs? Without question, we do. And in fact, some of this is contextualized a little bit by some work by Doug Wilms at the University of New Brunswick. I wanted to show you this just to also contextualize that all issues of mental health are not the same, nor do they show the same trajectory when we consider discussing them. I want you to look at this slide that I pulled out of a 2009 presentation by Wilms. Very interesting, because in my clinical work, we do both parent and child reports of anxiety and depression, and I want you to see the difference when we do that. If you'll look at the parental reports of anxiety for children under the age of 11, you see that parental reports of anxiety for both males and females hovers around 7 to 8%. When we start asking youth themselves or children themselves at about 10, and that's again where our most reliable measures, self-reports of anxiety and depression kick in as far as their validity and reliability, we now start to see that initially they're quite high, but then we see a gender split in that females consistently remain higher in their reports of anxiety, males lower, but again show that similar trajectory where they are, again, through the early teen years, 12, 13, 14, critical years for expressing this anxiety. Similarly, in depression, when we start to talk about depression rates by looking here specifically at, now we're just looking at youth self-reports, again we see a gender difference where females at around now later years in their adolescence, around 17 to 18, have the highest rates of depression, around 12 to 13%. Males peak out at around 5.5% or 6% over the trajectory. Now again, take this into context that when we talk about youth and child mental health, that I don't want you to miss hearing that when you see this data, also consider of, you know, even at our highest point of about 12.5% for females, that suggests that again about, you know, 87 to 88% of our youth are saying they are not reporting clinical levels of depression or anxiety. That's a good news message. We need to be communicating that, because so much of what we hear in the popular press and even in some poorly articulated research is that children and youth are not doing well and they're getting worse. The data suggests otherwise. Do we have a population of youth that are suffering? No question. Are the majority of our youth, though, not reporting this and not experiencing this? Again, yes, without question. Just wanted to show you again some behavioral data, again from Wilms, that he presents on alcohol use, marijuana use, early sexual experience, and tobacco use. And again, we do see that there is a singular trajectory of increase all the way from about 12, until we start to see things starting to level off between 16 and a half and 17 years of age, especially for alcohol use and tobacco use. Interestingly enough, marijuana use, you know, for those of us born in the 60s and 70s, or those of you that are older than that and can't remember the 60s and 70s, marijuana use is a highly, highly popular drug amongst our youth, both in recreational form and with the clinical population I work with as a form of self-medication. A lot of kids are dealing with their depression and anxieties through the use of street drugs, the softer street drugs. Okay, that's all you're going to hear from me. I seriously only have 5 minutes left? Do I really? Okay. Wow, that went fast. I thought I had until 3:15, Dave. Am I wrong?
Started really slow.
Okay, very good. We're going to get very quickly to a new way of thinking about children and youth. I want us to think about children and youth in a very different way, and then I want to present very quickly and in a way that you're going to hear in more detail in our publication that's coming out. Some of the work that's come out of a group that I've been involved with for about the last 6 or 8 years that's loosely called the Positive Youth Development Movement, or PYD. It's headed up by a couple of notable developmental psychologists, Rich Lerner from Tufts University and Bill Damon from Stanford University. And he has, these individuals have grown a discipline within developmental psychology that is really pushing the envelope to get us to think more about the strengths and assets that youth have rather than the deficits and illness that they have. So I'm not going to exhaustively go through these points. The key here is that children are seen as having the capacity for assets and ecological contexts as much or more so than they have the capacity for deficits and risk behaviors. Because again, one of the things I hear so much as a clinical psychologist is all of the risk behaviors that children expose themselves to, and as a result of this, the cost that this has both individually to the family and to the society. So one of the things that I wanted to show you was some evidence that says not only are children doing well, but in fact they're doing very well because of healthy social context that they live in. When we look at developmental assets, we can see anywhere from half to three quarters of youth in kind of that 12 to 15 age range report high levels of parental nurturance, high levels of school engagement. 80% of youth report a positive trajectory of peer connectedness, and at least 3 out of 4 are involved in volunteer activities. You probably saw the Jack Layton praising the volunteer movement within his that was driven largely by a very young populace of active volunteers within that political party that have had incredible outcomes as a result of this. Another set of data still coming out of this national longitudinal study of children and youth. Seem to be delayed here. Again, seems to show that we have a strong connection between, again, adolescents' mental health and the assets that they're promoting. I'm going to try and get to the slide that I want to. This is a very interesting set of data. This, again, comes out of Kelly Leach's report that looks at the trajectory of healthy development for children and youth. I want you to notice a couple things. And this comes out of this compares the 1994 wave with the 1996 wave of this data. You can see if you look across the top line that about just over half of children and youth are consistently experiencing positive development within their life. Whereas if you look at the bottom line, I'll get out of the way for some of you. If you look at the bottom line, you can see about 30% of youth would be considered consistently vulnerable from 1 year to the other. Here's the interesting part, though. The data was quite misleading in the sense that of that 71% that were considered not vulnerable in wave one, 14.9% of those at wave two did experience some vulnerability. So they did experience loss in family connectedness, loss in school engagement, loss in healthy peer relationships. Whereas, again, interestingly enough, 15% of those I think I have it circled. 15% of those that were considered vulnerable in wave one, actually at wave two, are no longer considered vulnerable. But in fact, they come to experience what we've come to know as resilience. This is very interesting data to me because, and for a singular purpose, efforts that you and I promote and support in regards to children's mental health cannot only focus on children that are vulnerable. It has to focus on all children and their development of their mental health. It cannot focus singularly on just rescuing or remediating those that are showing at risk or even in some cases clinical levels of behavior. And so where does this leave us? Well, this leaves us with trying to consider some actions here that I think are really important for us to consider, not only as kind of citizens, but also as a country. One of the things that we, again, I'm having trouble with this. One of the things that we want to promote is a system of intervention that's called asset-based mental health. And essentially what asset-based mental health is about considering, again, the social and familial context of children's development. And the focus of this is not just to consider how we remediate for children that are at risk for mental health issues, but in fact are for all children from, again, preschool all the way through to adolescence. And one of the areas that has been really interesting for me as a school psychologist to note is in Calgary we had just recently, as I think maybe most school jurisdictions have experienced, the Calgary Board of Education had to cut back on some of its funding for student services. And of course, one of the biggest cuts that takes place when that happens is in the area of support for children's mental health. And in fact, what has been lost is almost half of the school psychologists that were hired this year will not be offered positions next year in a school board of about 150,000 students. Now, beyond being disappointed for the new grads that I'm kicking out the door into the field of school psychology who aren't going to find employment, I'm more discouraged by the fact that what this is saying to us and our children is that we don't value the complete or the whole sense of what contributes to healthy child development. We are, as a school system, as we should be, engaged with the children's literacy, their language needs, their social needs, but we are not contributing or giving focus to their children's mental health needs. One of the studies that I'll cite in the paper that I'll present to you suggests that up to and above 50% of the kids that are identified with mental health issues are both identified and served within the school setting. Now that is putting a heavy load on our schools to do that, but what's happening here is we are addressing mental health issues and needs, and we are then having to serve those needs within that school setting. And as a result of this, these cutbacks, we are going to have a significant number of children in our Calgary area especially that are not going to be receiving those services. So what you'll hear me talk about in the paper that we're working on is, again, more exploration of this asset-based mental health service that focuses, again, not only on the needs of children who demonstrate risk and vulnerability, because we must and should do that, but also focuses on the development and promotion and prevention of mental health needs for all children, irrespective of whether or not they are identified early, mid, or late in the course of their development. So I'm going to close there with thanks to Dave and the Institute for their encouragement to write on this topic, and I do encourage feedback from you on this matter. And as we look forward to continuing our efforts as an institute, and as my part as research fellow, one of the things that I'm so appreciative of the institute is their willingness and openness to consider new frameworks of thinking about child and family development that may not be as mainstream as we experience. Thank you.
thank you very much, Kelly. We do have a few minutes that we can take some questions, so we can use the microphone over here if anybody would like to add into that. This is an area that challenges, and there's some interesting numbers there, and I thank you for the explanation there, Kelly, as well, of where some of those cross groups go. That actually was quite striking the first time I saw it as well. So, Jason, if you want to take the first question.
Yes, you mentioned the breakdown by gender of boys and girls for depression, but you did mention suicide. I've always seen different things that suggested that's a significant issue, and there's quite a striking gender breakdown on that.
There is. I'll confess that's not an area of my expertise. The only thing I do know is the number of attempted suicides and or what they call suicidal ideation, which is thoughts about suicide, does not differ much between males and females. The completion of suicide, though, does, where we see males successful completion of suicide much more than females. The flip side of that, though, is we see female self-harm behaviors much higher than we do males. So they, if they don't follow through and or complete with their suicide attempts, we do see lots of, that's where you kick in with the eating disorders and some other forms of self-mutilation that come with that too.
Suicide 2-to-1, 3-to-1, remember what do we
I don't think it's that, it's not that much difference. It's more about a 20% to 25% difference between males and females. The interesting thing, though, is we, because of the manners that males choose to attempt suicide, we're never sure if, and one of those is vehicular accidents, we're never sure if those are accidental or intentional, and thus it's likely that that number would be higher because, in fact, we can't discriminate whether or not it was an accident or intent. Yeah.
One question for you, Kelly, in that as well, and breaking out some of the percentages. Does the data show anything with regard to family makeup, economic overtones, inner city versus rural areas, and things of that nature?
Yeah, let me show you. One of the things we're going to talk about in the article is the notion of parenting style and parenting family style. And I'm going to focus on the positive, because what we see is that families who use a much more what they call authoritative parenting style, which is both has high expectations for the child but also a high responsiveness. In fact, I was struck by the one comment that came out of the National Post article here that said, family policies that don't allow parents sufficient time, energy, and opportunity to build close and healthy relationships with their children, oftentimes we see the negative outcomes of that. And one of the things that's coming out of the research that I'm involved with in the PYD group is that families that it's less about parenting style and more about parents exerting the energies to understand their children's developmental level. In fact, Peter, John, and I were talking last night about how when I get asked questions about, you know, tell me the top three things I should be doing as a parent with my child to ensure they grow up, I'll say, well, depends on which child you're asking me about in my own family, because the parenting style I use with each of my three kids differs according to their temperament and personality and makeup. And in fact, that to me is the key to healthy parenting, is being able as a parent to truly understand your child's developmental level and be responsive to that, not just uniformly, you know, issuing a certain parenting style or strategy. It's truly at that level of understanding.
Great. Oh, looks like Frank's got it.
First of all, I was wondering if you're going to look at the further cycles of the kids survey.
Yeah.
They're up to about 2007 now.
Yeah, or 2008. Yeah, you're right. Yep. I haven't yet. I'm looking as a third party to most of the NLSCY okay. data. Yeah.
There's also interesting data there on child and parent attendance at church or worship.
Right.
And I don't think that's been looked at. But in light of what Bradford just said,
yeah,
it seems to me that should be looked at.
Yeah. And you know what? I neglected to, which I'm usual, I think probably because of my audience here, I made an assumption. When I'm talking with other audiences, in psychology, as you know, we talk about the biopsychosocial model. And I'm often one to quickly say there's a fourth component on that, which is the spiritual component of our children's makeup. And in fact, yeah, there is lots of data that is talking about, in fact, we just heard it there, it's not necessarily about the religiosity of the family, it's about the family's engagement with that spirituality. I think we just heard that it was the praying with the child, it's the action of, you know, parents and child together that makes the most notable difference in outcomes. And the data is coming in through this PYD group that we're just coming up on some data that's 5 to 6 years old that is longitudinal in nature, that's going to look at the trajectory of how faith has ebbs and flows within family and how that connects with healthy development. And so we're pretty hopeful about that.
I'll look forward to seeing that.
Thanks. Thanks, Frank.
Well, thank you very much, Kelly. It's always a pleasure to hear and see you and hear what the latest research is telling us here. Will you please join me in thanking Kelly one more time? Okay.